The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. So good evening, everyone. Welcome to IMC. It's kind of special that we have this day along on Saturday with Lee Brasington. He's one of the preeminent teachers in our lineage now because of his emphasis on teaching concentration practice and jhana practice. He's one of the early teachers, Western teachers, who's kind of specializing in teaching that. And he's a friend of IMC and lively man. So he's coming here to teach. He's very deeply steeped in the suttas, the Buddha's teachings, and he's going to give a teachings on describing the progressive path, what's called the gradual path of practice that the Buddha taught. How's the sound? Is it good? To me, it's a little bit too loud. You want it louder? Okay. So for those of you who weren't here last week, I gave a talk about ease and the tremendous value that ease has as a teacher. That if you establish a modicum of ease, sense of peace, calm, well-being, and then you notice what takes you away from that, that you'll learn a lot about yourself. And the idea of learning about how we lose our ease, how we get anxious, how we get caught in attachments, how we get resentful, how we get afraid, how we get desirous and want things so much, how we lose our mindfulness, is a very important thing to understand. Because the more you understand about how you get caught, the less you'll get caught. If you don't see it and understand it, then it's easy to get swept away. So that reference point of having some ease, not that you have to be at ease it all the time, but that reference point is a powerful teacher. And it's nice to be able to live more at ease. And it's nice to question the things that cause you to lose your ease and to maybe not believe in that you need to lose it at all. So I think this teaching is a very important kind of teaching. But to put it in a little bit of context, this kind of teaching, is that it's very easy to think that this is a wonderful teaching for affluent people. That somehow emphasizing ease, just be at ease, everything's good, take it easy, then affluent people can just continue to live in their affluent world as if everything's okay and they don't have to be concerned about anything else, just live at ease. And I think that what I was trying to point to is actually the opposite. I hope that in what we teach, in teaching Buddhism, we teach the opposite. And that as we can learn a capacity of being at ease, that keeps us open and undefensive, open and unblocked, unresisting to seeing what's in the world for really what it is. And then as we see what's in the world, we don't rest back on our ease so we don't have to do anything, easeful inaction, complacency, but rather that sense of ease has helped, and freedom has helped free us from our fear and our laziness, help free us for the things that keep us from stepping forward to respond to the suffering of the world, if that's what we're encountering. So there's a kind of, the ease I'm talking about is a kind of openness that lets us experience the world and see the world, and we maintain our ease, even though it might break our hearts. And also, it makes it ease, makes it freer to respond and to act accordingly and to do something for the world, to make a difference. And, I've kind of devoted my life, my adult life, to doing Buddhist practice. And my initial call to engage in Buddhism was during the time of the Vietnam War. So it's a long time ago now for many people here. But it was a time of a lot of turmoil in this country. And I was of the draftable age. And in fact, I was up for the draft, one of the last drafts they had. I was kind of, you know, in the lottery for the draft. And so the idea of being drafted to go to war was very current among men in my generation, my age. And so having to really confront what it meant to be drafted, be sent to war, especially with some of us sent to a war we didn't believe in, sent to a war we didn't believe in war. I didn't believe in war. I wasn't going to participate. Was something that we were intensely engaged in, reflecting, thinking about, soul-searching about. And I was committed to not fight, to not kill. That I had almost a, I wasn't religious back then, but almost a religious orientation towards nonviolence. And so certainly was thinking about how, if I was drafted, what my alternatives were. And but as it was, in my year, I think I don't remember how many that, anyway, I was far down the list of the lottery. They didn't draft many, they didn't take many people from the draft that year. And then I think maybe the next year there was no draft, or they took even fewer. And but the point was, I was, you know, intensely engaged in this reflection about this. And my interest, my initial interest in Buddhism was not for my sense of ease or my own suffering, but I was looking for a way to respond, to be able to respond to the issues of war and violence in our society. And I was casting about and looking for many different approaches and ways of responding to the suffering of our world. And one of the things that bothered me a lot was that if I was going to follow through on my commitment to nonviolence action, nonviolent civil disobedience, because I didn't feel like nonviolence doesn't mean you don't put yourself, you know, put your life on in at risk, because you still, you know, fight, struggle against injustice. But I was very acutely aware that I was afraid of dying. I was afraid of standing there in the line with the police facing us back then. They were, you know, we had Kent State, and I was a college student, and college students were being killed and shot. Here in San Francisco State, there was, you know, all over, you know, there was the police and National Guard were brought onto the campuses. There was, you know, it was a tense time. And students were dying, many people were dying. And so I felt this fear, and it bothered me. I felt that there was a difference between my ideals and what I was able to live. And I wanted to find a way to be able to live my ideals and not have my inner limitations limit me from living the way I felt I wanted to live. And that became a very important quest of mine, was to find, you know, how can I bring these into harmony, my ideal and my inner life? And somehow I hit upon Buddhism as offering a practice that would help me to somehow deal with this fear that I had, somehow help me to overcome it. And that was my beginning, my entry point into Buddhism. And when I decided to take that turn, you know, I'd practiced for many years, and when I decided to take this turn towards eventually teaching, like I'm doing here, it was very much inspired not by helping affluent people be more comfortable in their affluence, someone was here yesterday at IMC, and it seemed like a wonderful group of professors, I believe, from the Midwest, who had gotten a grant to come to Silicon Valley and go visit a number of these big corporates like Google and LinkedIn and people to study innovation. And they were from different religious fields. Like there was a person from religious studies, person from sociology, from economics who came here to IMC. And they said, we came here because you're part of the Silicon Valley. So somehow we rated. You know, if you're going to study innovation in Silicon Valley, you come to IMC. So that was kind of nice. And then we had a little conversation about, about the innovation and about, you know, especially the secular mindfulness that's kind of in many places and all that. And you know what I thought about it. And I said, oh, it's great. I think the secular mindfulness movement and bringing mindfulness corporations is all good. It's all great. And I know we teach mindfulness here too. It's all good. However, in our Buddhist, teaching mindfulness in a Buddhist guise, in the Buddhist context, I'm hoping that mindfulness is also subversive. And what it's subversive for is for forces of greed, hate, and delusion. And that's kind of vague enough that everyone nods their head. It's, when you get to the details, that's when it gets interesting, right? But still, greed, hate, and delusion is underpins so much of what's problematic in our world. And if people are not driven by greed or not driven by hate or driven by delusion, I think that things would change radically. And I hope that to the degree to which our society or corporate economic society has an underpinnings of greed, hate, and delusion, I really hope that we address that and that there's a healthily subversive approach to what we do here if that's what's going on. And so the idea that what we do here at IMC, and maybe not so explicit often, but is actually a response to the suffering of the world. And I teach Buddhism and I train Buddhism. I don't say this explicitly, but I do have one of the motivations for doing this, because I believe that people who practice Buddhism sooner or later will live in such a way to better the world around them. That we heal ourselves and then we want to heal the world. And so some people, it's in small ways. It's to, their family and places of work or, you know, it's wherever we're called to do it. Some people, there are bigger places. There's no judgment of where it should be. But I really hope that what we're doing here is supports the world as a whole and helps it to heal and get better. And one of the ways in the current climate or any climate is to help people understand themselves deeply so that they can stay at ease, so they don't get alarmed, they don't get afraid, they don't get angry, they don't get lost in their blaming of everybody else, but rather they're able to kind of really see how their mind operates so their mind can stay clear, the heart can stay open, so we can really see what's happening. And then from the best parts of ourselves, enter into the world and find a response. One of my big inspirations when I was young, when I was doing all this searching and thinking about nonviolence, was Mahatma Gandhi. And I think that we can never study him enough. I think he's a great example of what can be done. But he's one example of many examples of people who've responded to the challenges of human life with in nonviolent ways. There was a book published by University of Columbia Press about 5 years ago, a study by some professors on nonviolent civil disobedience, nonviolent resistance. And they made the claim that in doing kind of revolutionary change in societies, that the movements that have been nonviolent are twice as effective as the ones that have been violent. And they have better results in the long term. they tend to create more democratic societies as a result. So I haven't read actually the book, so I can't tell you, you know, exactly what's in it. But I thought that was kind of fascinating, you know, statistics, twice as effective. Whereas many people's instinct is to go for violence, go for guns, more guns, you know, more bombing, something. And we certainly have a lot of wonderful examples of whole movements, whole countries that have been turned over from some kind of dictatorial government to authoritarian government to democracy. One of them in recent years was the Philippines. And millions of people came to the street, and President Marcos fled the country. The Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia is another example of one of the more beautiful, back in the late 90s, late 80s, transformations of a country where people rose in the streets. And we have kind of a mixed message now in Turkey over this in the last days, where a coup came to an end because the people came into the streets and faced the coup leaders. That movement's been taken advantage of now in other ways. So it's kind of a mixed thing, perhaps. One of the things that inspires me about Mahatma Gandhi was his dedication to truth. And as I understand what he had to teach, he seemed to say that no individual could really know the truth by him or herself, but that truth was discovered together with other people. You had to be in dialogue to find out what was really true. And that's why he said you have to be in dialogue with your opponents, and because together you'll find the truth. But if you think you have the only truth, then it's probably not the full picture. And he said that if you want your opponent to listen to you, you have to be willing to listen to them. And this idea that of reciprocity, of being a reciprocal relationship with the people that you're opposed to, I think it was central to what Gandhi was doing. I think he was always ready to talk to the English when they were trying to end the English rule of India. And I don't know if Gandhi was the first, but certainly he's one of the more strongest proponents of not being opposed to people, only to the actions of people, so that somehow we can stay in dialogue, stay in communication. And so the channels can be open so that some kind of change can happen in both directions, in all directions. And I think this whole idea is very important because I don't think that peace is the absence of conflict. I think conflict, we're always going to have conflict, always going to have difference of opinions, always going to have challenges between people. But so peace is not the absence of conflict, but peace has to do with the way in which we resolve the conflicts, the ways in which we approach and meet them and try to work it out. So here's a quote by Gandhi. Nonviolent resistance avoids not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. The nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but also refuses to hate him or her. So the idea that the care goes in both directions. We don't want to do violence to ourselves by hating. We don't want to do violence to others by hating them. And this idea that I think this is one of the consequences of this deep inner ease that can come from Buddhist practice is that we can have a real visceral experience of knowing, a feeling of how we create internal violence in ourselves if we get caught up in some of these strong inner afflictive emotions, hate, strong fear, hysteria, that we kept so easy to fall into. And then to learn to know that, and then learn how to practice with that and work with it. I don't think that it's realistic to assume that you're never going to have any hate again, never be afraid again, never have any lust again, greed, hate, and delusion again. That's the promise of Buddhism, but probably it's more realistic to live as if that's part of the deal in being a human being, just like it's part of the deal to live in a world of conflict. But we can learn to see it clearly enough to not get caught in it, to meet it with compassion, with kindness, and more importantly, meet it with freedom, so that these forces inside of us can grow up, can occur, but we don't succumb to them. We can have a practice to work with them and see them through to the other side. So here's a few Gandhi quotes. You must not lose faith in humanity. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty. So don't lose faith in humanity. I suppose leadership at one time meant muscles, but today it means getting along with people. I think that's great. Getting along with people, that's leadership. The difference between what we do and what we are capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. The difference between what we do and what we are capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. So what are we capable of doing? And what are you capable of doing? I think that when we encounter the kind of terrible events in the world that we're experiencing in the world these days, at least what we're reading in the media, I don't know how if it's more terrible than other times. There's a tendency in Buddhist teachings when there's terrible things happening in the world to kind of say, you know, it's been going on forever. This is not new. But I don't know, you know, whether it's more or less than it is now. I had a, I grew up in the shadow of World War II. And when I was growing up, you know, my grandfather spent time in a German prison camp. He was very proud of his time being a German prisoner, because he was sent out to a work crew to build a road in Norway. And he was very proud. He claimed that it was the road that that was built the slowest in human history. Listen. And he was there because he had some connection with the Norwegian resistance. My father-in-law survived the concentration camps, lost most of his family in the camps. So I grew up in the shadow of all that. My mother barely survived World War II because of Chaparral explosion, German. Ammunition ship exploded in the harbor of her town, and a big piece of the ship landed on her pillow through the window just after she'd gotten up out of bed. So, you know, stories of, like, I grew up with. So, you know, it was pretty awful. But it's bad enough as it's plenty bad enough these last weeks. 250 people killed in a suicide bomb in Baghdad, and killings in Bangladesh and in France, and here in the United States we have the killings going on around here. And And in this, in reading these things, learning about them, the difference between what we do and what we are capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. But I think that the beginning is what we can do, what I can do, what you can do. That if we only kind of are a witness to the problems of our society, and spouting our opinions and the blame and what people should do and what they should do and what's wrong with it, then I think we succumb maybe too easily to living in fear and anger and despair and kind of hopelessness. But I think that if you know, each person in their own way, if we're moved, if we're really affected by what we experience around us, if you're affected by it, then I think I hope that the call would be to respond in some way. And it could be in the smallest way possible. I read the news and for decades and have my heart broken regularly what goes on in the world. And I don't think that I could go and to Bangladesh and try to do something there. I don't think I could go to Baghdad, and I'm not capable of responding to all these things, right? But one of the things I try to do, I'm motivated by it to make a difference. So what I try to do is to try to be a better Buddhist teacher, because I feel that Buddhist practice is trying to help people suffer less here, help kind of diminish the forces of greed and hate here in this society, and I hope that that spreads from here. So I kind of channel that energy into responding in this situation here. Whether that's the wisest choice I can make, I don't know, but it's the one I've made. And so hopefully I'm doing a good enough job overall. And trying to make a difference that way. I love this quote. I do not want to foresee the future. I am concerned with taking care of the present. God has given me no control over the moment following. It's kind of remarkable for someone who is trying to free India from the English. Just living in the present. If we could change ourselves, the tendency in the world would also change. As a person changes his or her own nature, so does the attitude of the world change towards the person. As human beings, our greatness lies not so much in being able to remake the world, that is the myth of the atomic age, as in being able to remake ourselves. Gandhi repeatedly focused back on himself, on us as individuals, and practicing here, taking care of here. And I think his effectiveness stemmed from the fact that he was so focused on some kind of present moment practice here, with his own peace, his own ease, his own attention to not hating, coming from love, coming from generosity, coming from a willingness to meet everyone equally. A remarkable dedication. There's a story that appears, at a few different places, that he was asked once how he could be so effective, because apparently he worked 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. And his answer was, I'm always at rest. So he didn't need to rest. I guess the idea. So the idea there is, come back to this, and he used the word rest, the idea of ease. Learning how to stay in our ease, not get seduced into forces of despair or anger or fear. But to stay upright and open and peaceful, but not by shutting out things, but by staying open. Nobody can hurt me without my permission. That's a powerful statement, challenging one. It's one of those great koans to live with for a while. See how that works for you. Nobody can hurt me without my permission. The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. I claim to be a simple individual, liable to err, like any other fellow mortal. I own, however, that I have humility enough to confess my errors and to retrace my steps. It is unwise to be too sure of one's own wisdom. It is healthy to be reminded that the strongest might weaken and the wisest might err. Always aim at complete harmony of thought and word and deed. Always aim at purifying your thoughts and everything will be well. Kind of remarkable. He's also remarkable here. This great man who was involved in a political revolution, changing a whole nation, up against one of the strongest countries of the time. And always aim at complete harmony of thought, word, and deed. It requires mindfulness here for yourself. Don't lose touch with yourself. Stay attentive and present. Watch your thoughts, watch your deeds, watch what you say, and keep it clean, keep it pure, or keep it peaceful, or keep it loving, or keep it open, keep mindful. Always aim at purifying your thoughts, and everything will be well. That's a remarkable teaching of hope or possibility or something, that everything will be well. It begins here, in yourself. Purify your thoughts and everything will be well. How could that be? How could that be? I mean, the world's, you know, burning. And I'm supposed to focus on what I'm thinking and everything's going to be well. Why would he say that? How does that work? It's a kind of similar kind of teaching statement to the idea that you use your ease as your teacher. If you're able to stay close to your ease, stay close to your peace, and don't succumb to the forces of unease, the forces of agitation or even violence, everything will be well. In what way will everything be well? What does that mean? So I believe that if we really want to find a way to live in a world with so many challenges as we have, if we want to find a way to really find a sense of peace, we want to find a sense of purpose, a sense of hope, that the only way to find it is through our own actions. If you're expecting someone else to be the answer, then I think you'll succumb to despair over and over again. But if you have faith in your ability to make a difference, even if it's the smallest difference, but that you feel like you can do something, that you do count, you do make a difference for your neighbors, places of work, for your local communities, for wherever it is that you can make a difference, if you know that's the fact and have the experience of that being the fact, then you can have confidence in yourself. You have confidence in the difference you make. And it might not be enough to stop wars around the world, but it does make a difference. And then you won't succumb to the same level of despair and hopelessness that you'd succumb to if you have no experience of making a difference. No experience of making a difference in the world. If you don't have any, if you don't feel like you have any efficacy, it's a lot easier to succumb to deep discouragement and such things. And perhaps making a difference in the world, your response can begin by finding ease, by finding peace, by finding ability to stay in a healthy, wonderful way, balanced. And in that place, then, and from that place, stepping into the world and making a difference. And perhaps the biggest difference you can make is not what you do, but by the fact that you did it peacefully. Maybe it's contagious. Maybe other people see more how you are than what you do. And they say, wow, to be that way, that's quite something. I'd like to be like that, more than I want to be able to do what that person's doing. So maybe your ease is your gift. So those are my thoughts in response to what's been going on in the world. And we record these talks, so maybe just every 6 months we'll just replay it. So this is probably going to be, you know, relevant again and again and again. So do you have any comments you'd like to make? We have about 5-6 minutes. Any comments or questions?
Oh, thank you, Gil. Last week you talked about what draws us away from our ease, and that perhaps it's due to a lack of confidence, and that confidence comes from doing. But what if the thing that draws you away from your ease has more to do with, say, your inner life, like an irrational fear? Like a fear, uh-huh. Say a fear of being left behind, or some other fear that's more just an internal way of thinking. So how does one develop a sense of confidence in that context? Because that seems to have less to do with doing than...
Yeah, I don't see it so different from the world outside and the world inside. So... there's many, many ways in which you can do something about the inner world. So if you're afraid, you can take small steps to make a difference, to support yourself, to heal yourself, to work on that. And in the mindfulness practice, one of the ways to do that is to turn towards your fear and study it. Turn towards the fear and help your fear feel safe. And so if you can turn towards your fear and see it, just see it, and not be caught by it, step away from it in a sense and look back at it, and gaze upon it with compassion, and have a different relationship to it, and have confidence that being mindful is effective, it makes a difference, then you start shifting the balance from fear to confidence. Does that make sense? So that's done in small steps. It's not like overnight you suddenly can do it. But this little slogan, it can be helpful, that you want to look upon your fear so your fear feels safe. So you're not making it a problem. You're not trying to attack it or trying to fix it, because then it doesn't feel safe. But if you can hold it and then you can feel a certain inner strength that comes, that you can just hold it and be with it and accompany it, then something begins to thaw.
Thanks. Okay?
Right behind you there.
Are there things that we can do for friends who are searching for ease or who have been experiencing a lot of anxiety or issues with self-confidence lately?
I think that one of the first approaches always is to help them feel understood. Listen to them, accompany them, be with them. You know, don't be in a hurry to fix them, because most people, what they most want is to be understood and to be seen. But if you can do it, if you're not alarmed, if you're not kind of trying to fix them because you're uncomfortable, and they see, oh, is this person sitting next to me, and she's comfortable with me being uncomfortable, maybe I can relax. That's a beginning. I'll end with this, I've been now for, I guess, 15 years on an ethics committee. Okay, we deal with ethical challenges in a community, conflict in the community. And the thing that I've seen most often that makes a difference is when everyone involved feels understood. And if everyone feels understood, then generally things start moving and opening up. And then it's possible to look for what's the greatest good for everyone? What benefits everyone in the conflict? Rather than first and foremost looking at, you know, who's right and who's wrong, or who's bad, who's right, or something. But what is it that we can do to make everyone become better people and grow, everyone heal? And generally when there's conflict, I've seen that there's a lot of suffering in all directions. And so to kind of find a way to listen, to hear, to have people be understood, to be understood, to be listened to be understood, and to be respected are the really powerful forces of healing for everyone in our society. So to offer that to our friends, to listen, to understand, and to respect. Doesn't mean you have to agree. Okay, so I hope that this talk was okay. It was partly my attempt to speak about in response to what's happening in our world, and I hope it makes some difference for you. Thank you.